I'm very happy now to welcome Gretchen Purser. She's an assistant professor of sociology at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. She is working on a book called Labor on Demand, Dispatching the Urban Poor. And she's a summer scholar at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you write about the day labor industry, which many of us think of as those guys standing on the corner waiting to get picked up for construction jobs. But there's also a really big corporate formal day labor industry. What is it? What does it look like?
Well, yeah, what I have been studying in recent years, and I actually should just say that I got into this project by initially studying the informal day labor market. So I was, in fact, doing research on the street side, what they call shape-ups, where men wait around for employment. And it was through doing that research that I found out about companies that operate on that same day labor model of hiring and firing people every day. And that, in fact, had a business interest in expanding labor market flexibility, both on the side of supply and demand. So I decided to kind of develop my research by studying these formal companies. And what they are is they are a subsegment of the broader temporary staffing industry that operates on a very distinctive model. And I would really argue that there are two kind of critical characteristics that make a day labor agency. One of them is that the employment contract is day-to-day. So at the end of the day, if you manage to get work, you are then fired, or what they call deemed to have quit. So it's the most precarious form of employment you can possibly find in the formal sector.
Whereas if you are like a temporary accountant or something and they need you for 2 weeks, you have a 2-week contract.
Exactly, right. So the second characteristic that really distinguishes what a day labor agency is that you have to be physically present at the agency in order to be considered for the opportunity of employment. So these agencies operate as labor halls, or what is kind of colloquially talked about as body shops. And that really distinguishes them from other forms of temporary staffing agencies, where you just kind of call in or you receive a phone call and then get dispatched for a job.
Now, these companies basically hire ex-convicts. That's one of the main groups of people who are getting jobs this way. And they can't get hired in a lot of cases by any other kind of company.
Right, right. So I did my research in the two cities of Oakland, California, and Baltimore, Maryland. And certainly in my research, the dominant characteristics of the workforce were that they were African American, very precariously housed, so many of them outright homeless or living in shelters, others of them kind of doubling up in people's apartments, what have you, and formerly incarcerated. So that's the dominant characteristic of the workforce. And I think that would vary depending on what cities in which you do the research. But no matter what, no matter where you do this research, what you're going to find is that the population that goes to and relies upon day labor agencies are the most dispossessed in our society.
What kind of work are they doing every day? What are we talking about?
Actually, some of the companies that I've studied are, in fact, the largest employer, well, specifically the largest employer in the construction sector. So construction is one of the main industries into which people are getting jobs, but it goes way beyond construction. So it's construction, it's warehousing, it's manufacturing, you know, light assembly work, janitorial services, moving, like movers. A big thing that they do is disaster recovery efforts. Another big thing is event setup or teardown. You know, so if there's a huge event, they'll go in and set up the event. We worked on evictions, so we worked as eviction crews. And then all across the service sector, so we worked for large service companies doing work in restaurants, doing work in convention centers, doing work for the large retailers, all of which you know.
Right, right. And so these are folks that every single person probably listening to this broadcast has seen.
Absolutely, yeah. But the really interesting thing about this is that they're absolutely ubiquitous in almost every worksite you go into, right? But they're totally invisible. So the conditions of their employment are rendered completely invisible by this process.
Now, you actually worked as a day laborer in order to do your research.
Yeah, so I worked as a day laborer for about 3 years, both out of agencies in Oakland and in Baltimore. So this is a really long-standing tradition within sociological and anthropological scholarship of doing really embedded, intensive, what we can talk about is maybe carnal ethnography, right? Where you take on...
carnal ethnography.
Right. Where you take on the role in order to understand what's happening in that workplace.
And what kind of jobs did you do? I mean, what was your experience like? You show up and probably look a little bit out of place, being a rosy-cheeked white woman showing up at this place.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first went and started doing this field work, I mean, it was extraordinarily daunting. And all I can just say is that on my first day of field work, I mean, people just laughed the minute I walked in there and said I wanted to sign up for work. But that was only day one. And after I did this repeatedly, I became a completely normal, a completely accepted and expected member of the workforce. And I think what really changed it was when I actually got work. So after about 4 days or so of sitting in the agency waiting for work, I was finally dispatched to a construction job. And after I did that, my relationship with the other workers was really solidified.
Did you tell them what you were doing? I mean, were you kind of undercover?
I mean, in certain respects, you could say I was vis-a-vis the management. So I didn't tell the management of the companies that I was doing research. But I also didn't lie in any respect as to who I was. So I was I used my name. I was very clear that I was a graduate student doing graduate level coursework in sociology. But with the workers, it would be untenable for me to not explain to them what I was doing, right? Because my presence in these halls was so unexpected. So I was I told them what I was doing. And at the same time, you know, I can say, oh, I told them I was a sociologist doing research on the day labor industry, but that doesn't always make sense to the people in the real world, right? So their interpretation of who I was often that I was a journalist. Sometimes they thought I was like a parole officer. Sometimes they thought I was a spy, a corporate spy who was there to kind of spy on the staff of that particular agency, right? Because they thought these agencies were so corrupt. And so they understood me in a wide variety of ways.
Did you gain people's trust after a while?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
What kind of work did you do?
Oh, pretty much everything that I just went through. Construction, evictions. I worked as a flagger a lot.
What's a flagger?
A flagger is the person on a construction site who directs the traffic around the construction site. I have a lot of stories about that if you want to hear.
For example,
in the state of Maryland, I mean, flagging was the biggest job that went out of these agencies, right? So the majority of the workers every day were going out for flagging jobs in the summer, especially. And in order to work as a flagger in the state of Maryland, you have to be registered. You have to go through a state-certified training process and certification process. And so in order to be a flagger, you have to have a registered flagging card that the employer is supposed to check and is supposed to look at in conjunction with your state-issued photo ID to make sure that you are, in fact, the registered flagger. I myself never got a single day of training as a flagger and was simply dispatched with a fake certification card and sent out to these flagging sites to work as a flagger, which was pretty mind-boggling.
We're talking to sociologist Gretchen Purser. Now, this is a huge industry. Do we have any sense of how big it is?
I mean, one thing that's really complicated about this is that what I'm calling the day labor industry is not ever disaggregated from this broader temporary staffing industry that we know so much about, that there's been so much research about. And that, in fact, is in the news, you know, recently every single day. It's one of the dominant stories in the news, the growth of the temporary staffing industry. So no, we don't know exactly how big the day labor staffing component is, but we do have some evidence that kind of speaks to its growth and its size. So even the American Staffing Association has said that the day labor segment has been the fastest growing segment of temporary staffing throughout the late 1990s and early 2000s. We also know that temporary staffing has radically shifted over the last two decades. So today we have about 40% of all temporary staffing workers who are working in the what they call industrial sector. So we can surmise that a vast majority of those workers are in fact day laborers. And that's a total shift from what we saw before, where the vast majority of temporary staffing workers were working in clerical. So we've seen both an occupational shift and a gendered shift in the nature of who makes up the temporary staffing workforce.
Meaning more men now than women?
Yeah, not necessarily more, but significantly more than there were in the past, men than women. Because when temporary staffing got started, it was really started. I mean, it was advertised as, and it was started kind of as women's employment. And there's been a lot of good research that documents this, including a new book by Erin Hatton that's called The Temp Economy. And it's on kind of the Kelly girl strategy that temp companies use to get started and to develop legitimacy in the labor market.
So this industry has kind of gone hand in hand with the explosive growth of the prison industry and the growth of the number of people who are in prison. I mean, when I was a kid, it was a tiny number compared to what it is now.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like as soon as these people get out of prison, and it's many, many people every year, and they can't get jobs, they are really vulnerable to these kinds of agencies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I've really tried to do in my work is to engage with this literature about the labor market effects of mass incarceration. And most people who are writing about this have just talked about how mass incarceration explodes the number of unemployed people in our society. It both absorbs the unemployed by incarcerating them, so it artificially kind of deflates the rate of unemployment in the United States. We have really good evidence showing that. But then what it does is because the vast majority of inmates are going to be released, it exacerbates unemployment in the long run by creating people who are rendered pretty unemployable in today's contemporary labor market. But what I've tried to do is to show that, in fact, these people are unemployed, but a lot of them are, in fact, working. And they're being strategically absorbed into this sector, this bottom level sector of the labor market in the form of these day labor agencies, which actually have really clear links to a lot of prisoner reentry programs. So they actually recruit their bodies. And this is how the dispatchers actually talk about these agencies. They talk about recruiting bodies. They recruit these bodies from prisoner reentry programs to get the most vulnerable, dispossessed people to become these hyper flexible, hyper exploitable workers.
And how much do they pay them?
Oh, the work in a day labor agency is almost always minimum wage, sometimes a little bit more than minimum wage.
But then there are fees and things that they take out?
Right. So it's minimum wage or just above minimum wage, and then there's a whole assortment of fees that are taken from your daily paycheck. So that includes fees for transportation. So in my case, when I was doing my research, that was $7 a day. It often, in many states, includes fees for your safety equipment that you're mandated to have in order to get the job in the first place. It can include fees for just being able to cash your check at the end of the day, right? Because you're given a check stub, and a lot of these agencies have check cashing facilities right inside the hall. And in order to get your cash at the end of the day, because remember, many of these people are, in fact, like unbanked people. They don't have banking accounts. The machines take a dollar in all of the change on your paycheck. So for many of these workers, I mean, they're making far below minimum wage. And that's not even getting into issues of like child support that's deducted from a paycheck before you even, you know, see it. So, you know, literally I would work sometimes, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours alongside workers, and we would come back and their pay stub literally would be $12.
What?
Yeah, literally.
You were making a dollar an hour?
For many of them, right? Because the state was actually taking out child support directly from the paycheck.
So if that person owed child support for the child they had. But what if you didn't owe child support? I mean, they were taking out all those fees. You work a 10-hour day.
Yeah, you can make $40. Yeah.
So you were making like $4
an hour. Yeah, it depends. Because, right, for a lot of these workers also, in addition to all the fees, sometimes the dispatcher will kind of loan you money before you go out on the job to help you, for example, pay for lunch. So a lot of people are in debt before they even start the job, because we're really talking, again, about some of the most impoverished people in our society who are getting these kinds of jobs.
Now, meanwhile, these are people who, they come home from a really hard day's work. I mean, a lot of this is tough work, physical labor. You're sweating, you're in the hot
Absolutely.
Sun, you're working in a warehouse. You come home with a paycheck of $20, $40, $12, and how are you supposed to live? I mean, are these people literally living on the street? Are they living in shelters?
Yeah. I mean, it really, it kind of spans. I mean, people absolutely are living on the street. People are absolutely living in shelters. And in fact, many day labor agencies strategically locate themselves right next to shelters. So they really have very strong connections to homeless shelters in our society. And then many of them, like I said, are, you know, doubled up with family, doubled up with friends. Very few of the men and women I got to know over the course of the 3 years of fieldwork actually had their own place. I mean, that would be very rare. So they're surviving day to day. I mean, there's really no better way to put it. They're surviving day to day. And what it means is that the next morning they wake up and they do it all over again. And I'm not sure if I fully explained what it means to be a day laborer, but what it means is you wake up at 4:30 in the morning to get down to one of these labor halls by 5:30 in the morning and sign up. And you really start every day not knowing whether or not you're going to get work. And even if you do get work, you have no idea where you're going to go, what you're going to do, who you're going to be with, who's going to be your boss, who's going to drive you there, whether there's going to be food or water even available at the job site. So really just an extraordinary and extreme amount of uncertainty. So much so that it's really, really hard to actually put it into words just how much uncertainty you're living with. And the dispatchers dispatch jobs according to what they call best match for dispatch. So what that means is that they have discretion to send out whoever they think they want to send out for any particular job. So there's no really kind of rational system for distributing the jobs that come in that day. So workers are really at the mercy of the dispatchers, which leads to all kinds of crazy things in the labor hall, of course.
Give me an example.
I mean, extortion, workers competing to do favors for the dispatcher, right? Because everyone is trying to get in with the dispatcher to the extent that their own sense of dignity can stand it. So, you know, people will compete to like run favors for the dispatchers, like go pick up McDonald's or go pick up donuts for them or bring them coffee, or they compete to even clean up the hall. So, you know, what you have is like would-be workers, right? They're not workers yet. They're wannabe workers, not getting paid for sitting. They're not paid while they're waiting, who are like performing all kinds of unpaid duties in the hopes that they might get, you know, what's called get on a ticket or get a job for that day. So waiting is really one of the absolutely critical and central things that a day laborer does.
Meanwhile, they're sitting there waiting and they have to be in the hall so they can't go out and look for other work.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's one of the really, really, I mean, just amazing things that's going on in the day labor industry, which is that because it requires a physical presence in the hall in order to be considered for employment, it means that these workers cannot actually simultaneously be looking for other jobs. So in a way, what the agencies are trying to do is to stabilize an on-demand, immediately dispatchable, and super exploitable workforce, right? So they have every interest in kind of keeping a surplus pool of laborers in the hall for the duration of the day. And so what that means is that there's a lot of emphasis by the dispatchers on the kind of virtue of patience, right? So when workers just like are, you know, 3-4 hours into the day, they're about to give up, the dispatchers will say something to them, you know, trying to teach them the virtue of patience. This is happening day in and day out.
And meanwhile, I mean, these temporary staffing agencies bill themselves as a kind of like do-gooder re-entry from prison into society kind of thing, and actually get significant amounts of federal funding.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they absolutely have tapped into this logic of what they call offering an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. They have all kinds of language like this or discourse like this that really taps into kind of what we could talk about more generally as a neoliberal discourse. They talk about offering this honest day's pay for an honest day's work to those who would otherwise be mired in the underground or illicit economies of the street. They talk about offering an opportunity. So opportunity is probably the biggest kind of word that you hear in their promotional materials all the time. And I just find that really important to analyze this discourse of opportunity, because in fact, these temp agencies or day labor agencies, you know, they're presenting themselves as if they're opening the door to the labor market. But in fact, all the research shows that they're actually just transforming the nature of that door, because what they're doing is they're totally shifting the very nature of the way the labor market works. So they're not opening the door to the labor market. They're actually eradicating entry-level jobs. They are becoming the very door to the labor market. You know, they're becoming the normalized way in which people access and gain employment in our society today.
Well, when you talk about dead-end jobs, that is the ultimate dead-end job, and it's a huge sector. I mean, what's millions of people,
right?
Yeah,
it's millions of people, yeah.
Who will never be able to get ahead.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the agencies would deny that, right? They would say that, in fact, no, many of the workers get full-time jobs. But I spent 3 years working in these companies, and there wasn't a single worker that I worked alongside that got a full-time company for one of the employers to which we were dispatched. The only person that I know who was offered a full-time job was me.
What were you offered?
I was offered a full-time job the very first day I got a job at a day labor agency, and which I just think speaks in such a profound way to my racial and gendered privilege in this labor market. So I was out on a construction site, and the foreman, it was my very first day ever on a construction site, and the foreman came up to me and offered me a full-time job in the office. He didn't want me to be doing manual labor. He wanted to take me as what he saw as a competent white woman and give me a job ordering lumber in his construction office.
We're talking to sociologist Gretchen Purser about the day labor industry. Now, the people who you were working with, a lot of them ex-convicts, probably most of them ex-convicts, is that correct?
Yeah.
They had presumably some skills that, had they been given the opportunity, they could have really brought to bear and made better money and gotten respect and, after having paid their debt to society and so on, actually rebuilt some kind of a life.
Yeah, and there's no doubt. I mean, many, many, many of the workers are highly skilled, but they're just channeled into this particular sector, you know, which bills itself as all unskilled employment. And there's certainly no training for any job that you're given. I mean, not even any orientation to any works that you go out to. But yeah, absolutely, people could be thriving in other sectors. I mean, if you can thrive in the day labor sector, then you have proven yourself a pretty unbelievable worker, because the work ethic that these people exhibit is really unparalleled to anything else I've ever seen, really.
How do they experience their lives as day laborers? What do they think about these companies that are employing them?
It's really complicated. I mean, universally, they see these companies as deeply, deeply, deeply exploitative businesses. I mean, just there's no ambiguity in their assessment of these companies as being exploiters of the highest degree. But they also feel incredibly dependent upon them, because they see them as their only route to having any access to the formal labor market. And so they're really caught in this really kind of contradictory position vis-a-vis these day labor companies. I mean, in one respect, they see them as the tool or mechanism they need in order to navigate what they see more broadly as a highly discriminatory labor market. So they see the day labor agency as a way in which, as African American formerly incarcerated, predominantly men, they can get access to any kind of work. But they certainly see these companies as really just making a buck off of their hard labor.
Which they are. I mean, these companies must be incredibly successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they charge about double the rate to the employers that they pay the workers. So, you know, they are paying workers compensation and all of that. But, I mean, they're certainly making a significant profit off of each hour that a laborer is working at an employer's work site.
And they're getting the federal subsidies for helping people getting out of prison.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is we're talking about the Work Opportunity Tax Credit, which enables employers to tap into a federal tax credit if they put to work both people who are coming off of the welfare system and people who are formerly incarcerated, along with a number of other kind of disadvantaged labor market populations.
So while working for these agencies isn't like being in prison, in some ways it almost is.
One of the things that a lot of these workers talk about is that the agencies, you know, it reminds them so much of kind of being in prison. So they talk about, you know, they talk about doing time. Because remember, the majority of what they do is they wait for work in a confined space. And so they find all of these parallels between their former life as an incarcerated person and their current life as a formerly incarcerated day laborer. So they talk about, you know, these agencies as kind of being akin to this continuation of doing time. And a lot of them really, they're very dispossessed, right? The economic pressure to just survive day to day is huge, and certainly what's pushing many of them into these agencies. But the other key component to this is that many of them, as a condition of their parole, they have to show evidence of gainful employment. So they're being both excluded from the labor market by virtue of their formerly incarcerated status, but also being pushed into the formal labor market, right? Mandated right. That they must work in the formal labor market. So many of them see these agencies as they're really their sole path to showing evidence of gainful employment in the form of a pay stub. So many of them need to get that pay stub in order to just get the parole officer off their back for the week, you know? So that's a huge thing.
And meanwhile, they're waiting around in a humiliating position where somebody else is in charge of their life in a big windowless room, and it really must feel a lot like prison.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they really see these dispatchers as absolute tyrants, or they see them as incompetent, and that's a huge topic of conversation every single morning, is the incompetence of the dispatchers, because a lot of what they do is like, so they see these agencies as deeply, deeply exploitative. in this big sense, but in the day-to-day, what they focus on is the failure of the agencies to garner enough employment to put them all to work on a consistent, stable basis. And I find that kind of depoliticizing. So a lot of them will tell you, like, if only the dispatcher would do her job correctly, you know, we'd all get out to work today. You know, if only the dispatcher wasn't so lazy herself, then this could be a good gig, because maybe the crazy uncertainty of it would be eradicated and we would get work every single day. It would still be low paid work. It wouldn't be good work. It would still be hard work. But they get caught up in that and kind of blaming the dispatchers, as opposed to recognizing that this whole system is about really deeply exploiting them and making it possible to outsource the most dangerous, the most degraded forms of employment to a highly degraded workforce.
Some of them must get the exploitation angle on a political level, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, you see both, you see contradictory kind of strands of discourse coming up, depending on the nature of the day.
Tell us a little bit about the women workers. The majority of them are African American men, but mm-hmm. who are the women and what are their lives like?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely women, and I studied many different companies, I should say. And so some of the agencies even had more women than men at the particular time when I was doing the research. And that's because of the nature of whatever contract the companies have at that time. So there were certainly women in these agencies, and at agencies that would have like more kind of service or assembly line or warehousing contracts, you would see a bigger proportion of women there than in other agencies. I think one of the really interesting stories to tell about gender is the way in which the agencies do the work of gender discrimination for the benefit of the employers in really explicit and completely illegal ways. So an employer will call an agency and say, I need 4 men to come do this job. And the dispatcher will send 4 men to go do that job. But that is an illegal practice, right? That's discrimination on the basis of gender. And so by outsourcing work to staffing agencies, it enables employers to get away with gender discrimination that it would be very hard for them to get away with if they were doing their own hiring.
And so the experience of these women is they're doing different kinds of jobs than the men in general?
Often, yeah. So oftentimes what will happen, the dispatcher will send a crew out, and it'll entail maybe, let's say, 18 men and 4 women. And then what happens when you get to a job site is that the foreman or, you know, the employer of that day will distribute job tasks in a way that's really, really excessively gendered. And so, you really see it in ways that I don't think you see more generally in the labor market, but it's so explicit in the day labor sector. So, for example, I would often go to jobs and all the men would be put on one task, say moving furniture, and all the women would be put on another like lighter task of like picking up trash. I went to one job where I was given a pink hard hat by the day labor agency. All of the men had yellow hard hats. So when I went to the site, and this was the site at this point was a port, a railroad yard at a port, I was immediately visible as the woman. So then when I get there with my pink hard hat, the employer actually asks me if I will be the supervisor for the rest of the team that day.
Very interesting. I don't know, when you talk about this, I sort of have mixed feelings about it. If I were a day laborer and a female, I might want to do the lighter tasks.
Yeah. But still, I mean, a lot of women can do much harder work than many of the men can. So by just, you know, it is discriminatory. And
yeah,
it can disadvantage, you know, either gender, depending on what the contract is.
So let's talk about the women. Are they also generally ex-convicts?
I mean, some of them, for sure. And some of them are homeless. Some of them are victims of domestic abuse and have really nowhere else to turn. I mean, their lives are so unstable. And they make use of these day labor agencies for employment.
We're talking to sociologist Gretchen Purser, talking about the formal day labor industry. What is the model that was the basis for this industry? Was it based on like manufacturing? I mean, the product that they're selling is essentially people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the big companies was actually founded by a hamburger franchisor who decided to apply the principles of fast food to units of human labor. So, I mean, really, yeah, what this is just-in-time employment, similar to what you would find in just-in-time manufacturing. So it's the production of just-in-time workers, right? On-demand workers.
So we are producing workers and we don't really think about the fact that they're human beings and have their needs. We think about just getting them out on the site.
That's right.
Collecting their pay, essentially collecting their paycheck, giving a little part of it to them.
Right. I mean, what the day labor agencies, what they primarily do, what their primary responsibility really is to ensure that they have a surplus labor pool that is ready and willing to meet employers' daily and unpredictable demands. I mean, so that's what the dispatchers do, is like they drum up bodies. They have to ensure that they have surplus bodies in the event that an employer calls and says, I need 30 workers to come out and to move boxes all day, or I need 30 workers to come and clean these fields, or whatever the task is.
One then thinks, well, if that person, for example, was in jail for selling drugs, and then they come out, there would be a great temptation to go back to their previous life because the money's so much better and the work is right. So much easier and it's less humiliating and all of that.
Right. And I mean, certainly those two economies are not mutually exclusive. I mean, many of these people are surviving on the wages that they earn as a day laborer, and many of them are absolutely combining this kind of work with other kind of informal or perhaps illegal income-generating activities. And a lot of times you even see that within the agency itself. So a lot of people are like hustling little things, right? Like hustling t-shirts, hustling socks. You know, there's all kinds of money-making activities that are going on in this sector of society.
When we look at the history of this country, there's been exploitation since the beginning. I mean, this country started with slavery. And there's a kind of chain of exploitation, especially of African American labor, which has been unbroken for many centuries.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what's really notable about hanging out with day laborers, I mean, these day laborers in the formal sector, is just the extent to which slavery is the discourse that's used to talk about what's going on, right? So they totally denounce these jobs as slave jobs. They see the day labor employment relationship, which is a triangular employment relationship between the worker, the agency, and the employer. They see it as really akin to the triangular employment relationship of slavery between the slave owner, the slave trader, and the slave. And so they draw out those parallels all the time. It's either slavery or it's prostitution or it's prison. I mean, and they talk about those kind of institutions as the parallels to what's going on in their own lives.
Nobody knows about this.
Yeah.
I imagine that you're kind of trying to bring it out in your work as a sociologist.
Yeah, I'm absolutely trying to bring it out. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think it's really a crazy situation because they are ubiquitous. You could go to any city right now and find a formal day labor agency, right, that's operating on this model.
Even Santa Fe,
absolutely. But the thing is, these workers, as I said earlier, I mean, they are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. They're at the ballpark selling you concessions. They're on the back of, you know, garbage and recycling trucks. They're cleaning up parks. They're working in warehouses. They're working in factories. They're working all over. But the conditions of their employment, their status as a day laborer, is completely invisible to people's view.
Do the people who, the employers, in other words, who say, I need 10 guys for a day, do they have any idea?
They often don't, and I find that really problematic, because what happens is that, this is how I talk about it, the day laborers are fighting two battles on a daily basis. They have two battles to fight. And I talk about this using the concept of flexploitation, right? So I say that day laborers really illustrate what flexploitation means in the contemporary...
Flexible exploitation.
Exactly. Flexible exploitation. So that day laborers really are straddling between superfluidity and indispensability vis-a-vis the needs of capital. Here's the two battles that day laborers have to fight every day. On the one hand, what they're fighting for is the battle to be exploited in this Marxian sense, right? The battle to actually get work. So all morning long, they are fighting a battle to be exploited.
And as you've said, they're doing favors and trying to make themselves look attractive and so on.
Exactly. And then once they get onto a job site, they're fighting the battle to resist exploitation, right? And many times that exploitation is really intense because supervisors can get away with all kinds of things when they have day laborers on the site.
It's like another immigrant situation. I mean, we've had wage theft and all sorts of things here, just in Santa Fe and all over the country. It's the same kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but what this does for day laborers is that if they fight that second battle, that is the battle to resist exploitation, they really will end up losing the first battle. That is the battle to be exploited in the first place. And how that works in the day labor industry is that if you talk smack to your employer, if you refuse to do a job, if you do a bad job, if you cop an attitude, you're going to be sent home, you know, sent back with a do not return label marked on your ticket, right? And sometimes you're actually just sent back immediately. I mean, just immediately, you're just like discarded. And what that does is it's the basis upon which dispatchers then distribute jobs, right? Those do not return signs. So to resist exploitation makes it almost impossible for these workers to be exploited in the first place, right? To get work. And so they're really caught in this conundrum, and it creates just a really excessive amount of demoralization and rage that come out in other ways, but it's really intense and they're really caught in that battle every single day.
Now, we've talked about African-American ex-convicts being the primary part of this labor force. What about immigrants? Are they part of this formal day labor industry?
In the cities where I conducted this research, which again were Oakland, California, and Baltimore, Maryland, the workforce was overwhelmingly comprised of African-American and white workers. And there were no immigrant workers in these sites. We do have evidence that in other cities, these companies are more deliberately targeting immigrant workers. So, for example, the research that's come out of Chicago shows that the agencies actually locate themselves in predominantly immigrant neighborhoods, as opposed to predominantly African-American neighborhoods, like my research shows. So in my research, the only barrier to entering these companies is that you have documentation to work. I mean, the other thing going on here is that when a Latino worker would occasionally come into the agencies, they would really be immediately kind of shooed away. And I'm saying it was informal, but it would definitely happen. So oftentimes the African-American workers would say, you know, this is our place. You know, this is not your place. I have an interview with a dispatcher who made really clear that she could not have both immigrant and African-American workers working together out of the same agency. And so she was just really clear, like, they go somewhere else, they don't come here. And she didn't really say much more than that. So, in my cities, the big kind of racial division was a division that overlapped with the formal day labor and the informal day labor divide. So both in Baltimore and in Oakland, you see a tremendous number of immigrant day laborers, but they are working out of the street corners, right? They're working on the streets.
So that's the informal sector.
Exactly.
Now, all of this that you've been describing in this hour, is this completely legal? I mean, you talked about employment discrimination. So that, besides that.
Although the agencies are absolutely legal, legitimate, formal companies. And yet they violate almost every single labor law and employment standard that's on the books, right? And I have evidence of that. You know, this is across the board. I mean, there's all kinds of violations of labor standards. And even when it's not a violation of labor standards, what we see is that these companies are really degrading the nature of work in our society today. So yeah, they're legal businesses that, just like so many other legal employers today, get away with a lot of illegal employment practices.
Is anybody coming after them?
There was a big campaign that was kind of waged by the construction trades of the AFL-CIO back in the late 1990s that went after some of these companies because of workers' compensation misclassification. Other than that, I have not seen much kind of activist attention being given to what's going on in these agencies.
And if the people who are being employed themselves try to become activists, then they're not going to get work.
Exactly, right. They're very limited in what kind of resistance they can take up, right? Because of that kind of dependency that they feel on these agencies. So you have seen a lot of kind of activism about day labor, but like I was just saying, it's overwhelmingly kind of geared towards the informal day labor market. So we've seen the construction of a lot of worker centers, right? Or day labor worker centers that try to provide predominantly immigrant workers who stand on street corners with a more dignified place to wait for work, with access to services that they might need, with some sort of registration process so that they're not kind of working in this totally anonymous labor market, which makes them more vulnerable to, you know, exploitation. So you've seen that, but a lot of these worker centers or labor activists haven't really paid as much attention to what's happening in the formal day labor sector.
What is your hope for this work?
Well, certainly, I mean, I guess I have several hopes for it. You know, from a more academic perspective, I think the day labor industry is kind of like a beacon of what's happening more broadly in the labor market. So I think by really intensively studying what's going on in the sector, we both can have greater insight into how the labor market is changing, how the nature of work is changing, how exploitation is experienced in the contemporary economy. I also think it gives us a tremendous insight into urban poverty, you know, the nature of contemporary urban poverty, right? Which is not entirely about joblessness, as has often been talked about, but about maybe joblessness, but not the absence of work, right? So that's kind of how I talk about it. Like, yes, a lot of these people are jobless, absolutely, right? They're hired and fired every day, but they are in fact working.
Yeah, they might be working 40, 50, 60 hours a week, exactly. And they're still jobless and they're still poor.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, that's kind of my goals as an academic. I think as an activist also, I really certainly am trying to shed light on what's going on in these companies. I think we have to figure out some way of organizing day laborers. And I think it's a really, really difficult task, given the degree of precarity that this industry represents.
Well, there's a very poignant line in one of your papers where one of the workers was talking to you and said, I want you to tell people about this.
Yeah.
But not shut down the company.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about when I say that they are really stuck in this contradictory position where they absolutely want people to know about exploitation that's going on in this business, and yet they feel dependent upon it as their sole source of income generation. And so it's a tricky thing, right? We obviously need to create entry-level job opportunities that, in fact, support people, right? That provide a living wage, that ensure people's health and safety on the job. You know, using day labor and using, you know, temporary staffing as the kind of new entry-level jobs isn't sufficient, right? I mean, we've seen what these agencies have done. They've really degraded the nature of employment in society today. So no longer do we have great unionized entry-level job positions for people who are trying to make their way in the labor market. And I think that's a huge problem for us.
What would be a better model for people getting out of prison? So you've got somebody who's been in prison for 1 year, 5 years, 20 years. That person mm-hmm. might have some skills. They've paid their debt to society. And yet it's like for felons, ex-felons, they can never pay their debt to society because they're never employable again. They're never eligible for public housing and so on again. What would be a better model than this to let them actually reenter into society in a productive way?
Well, certainly paying poverty-level wages is not going to help people reenter society. There's no way that doing these jobs helps people reintegrate back into society. I mean, it mandates that they stay in poverty, in deep, 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 really atrocious poverty, because I hope that listeners understand that the minimum wage does not, in fact, enable someone to live with decency.
Not to mention the minimum wage minus transportation yeah. and safety equipment and all of that.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think we need to create job opportunities. Like I said earlier, we need to create entry-level job opportunities that have an actual ladder to mobility, that have a pathway toward stability, toward real economic gains. And I think that's the path towards actually reintegrating these people into society.
I think there's also a larger conversation about economic growth. I mean, I think there is a kind of U.S. post-war model of economic growth that has to do with providing lots of people things that they need. But now we have a model of economic growth. It's like everybody's got what they need times a gazillion, especially in this country. And so in order for companies to survive, they have to keep on cutting costs. And part of cutting costs means paying people less and less and finding ways to cut full-time jobs and have temporary workers and pay temporary workers less and so on. And that's part of what actually constitutes economic growth in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things that the growth of day labor and all other kinds of like super low-paid, precarious employment should teach us is that work is not the solution to the problem of poverty. I mean, work isn't working. There's no doubt about that. And so we need to create models for social insurance that aren't bound up with the workplace, right? I mean, the minimum wage, for example, if it had stayed in place with the rate of inflation, would be like $28 an hour. So we really have a kind of crisis of work on our hands. And I think that's what my research really speaks to.
I have to say, when I try to put myself in your position doing this, I mean, obviously you're in better shape than the people you were working with, but it must have been so hard. I mean, I would have cried myself to sleep at night witnessing the things that you did.
It was very hard, but I was so incredibly driven too that I've also probably never had more. I don't know. I love doing field work. I'm really, really committed to ethnographic work. But it was really hard for a number of different reasons. I mean, the uncertainty is really unparalleled, so I couldn't have a normal life. And in fact, I do have another life, right? I am a professor, I'm a grad student, you know, whatever. So I had other obligations, but when you're working as a day laborer, you can't have other obligations. So, you know, I was able to do this because of certain conditions in my own life. Like, I didn't have children. If you had kids, it would be almost impossible to work as a day laborer because you never know if you're going to get work. Even if you do get work, you have no idea where you're going to get off of work.
And you certainly can't afford childcare.
And you can't afford childcare, right? So, I mean, I was in a position where I could do this kind of field work. But so what it really entailed was, you know, like I said, waking up at 4:30 in the morning, getting to the agency by 5:30, signing up, waiting for, you know, an indefinite number of hours just in this hall. Like, you know, just waiting, then going out to some random job, which usually changed every single day. So, and the jobs were usually very dirty and very dangerous. And your body as a day laborer is not accustomed to doing that particular kind of job, right? And so you might be super sore from the job you did the day before. And now you're doing something totally different and
using a different set of muscles.
Using a different set of muscles, right? So that's, I mean, I can't overstate that, the extent to which these jobs are hard. Even working on an assembly line is incredibly difficult. And the first day you do it, your arm feels like it's going to fall off. So the fact that day laborers are moving from different jobs all the time and never kind of developing that kind of bodily routine is very difficult. And then for me as an ethnographer, after I got off the job, my job was to, in fact, write up everything that happened that day. So I would often write literally 20 pages of single-spaced field notes of everything that had happened that day. I mean, I write, like, extremely detailed field notes. And I had been taking them, you know, scribbling them on a little piece of paper, kind of like a journalist might do, all day long. But then I would go home and I would translate my scribblings into full-fledged, well-written ethnographic field notes. So it was very, very grueling. And I would wake up the next morning and do it all over again.
And you did this for years?
Yeah, I did this for years. Yeah, off and on. I would have, you know, I would get teaching appointments that would render it impossible for me to do, you know, this kind of intensive field work. But when you put it all together, it was 3 years of field work.
Gretchen Purser is a sociologist. She is an assistant professor of sociology at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. She is working on a book called Labor on Demand, Dispatching the Urban Poor, and is a summer scholar in Santa Fe at the School for Advanced Research. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.